Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Simon Barrett, and this is another edition of America's Most Unwanted and the People That Find Them. I have a great panel today. Recovery agent William Cobra Storbs. Cobra, it's always a delight to chat with you.
Simon, it's always my pleasure, and I hope your cold subsides for us today, my brother. I feel bad that you feel bad.
Oh, I'm sure I'll survive. And also, we have recovery agent Matthew Todd. Matt, always delightful to chat with you.
Ditto, Simon. Thanks for having me on.
And we are expecting a couple of other guests, but also joining us this week is Dale Miller, owner of Romelli Bail Bonds in Sonoma, California. Dale, wonderful to have you on the program.
Thank you very much, Simon. I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with such illustrious people as are on here.
Oh, Lord. That sort of talk won't get you anywhere. The reason I invited Dale was a story that Cobra sent me about what was happening in Sonoma, California. Cobra, would you care to give us the intro on this?
Yeah, I don't know a whole lot about it, but I know this. A lot of bondsmen were liking the idea that some judge out there decided that within 15 days, if the state didn't put their case together or whatever, that they was getting off the bond. They were canceling the bond, and then if they decided to bring the case, then they had to get another bond. Basically, where we do it in Florida, we would do a rewrite, but out there, they just nullify the bond, so you're out the 10%, and then if they decide to bring charges on you again, you got to come up with another 10% and do the whole thing all over again. I looked at it as a segue to introduce pretrial as a good reason not to go with a professional bondsman because it was costing you too much money. So I'm glad you got one of the experts that lives in that county, knows more about it than I do. But when I saw it, I posted it on Facebook and I said, guys, what do you think of this? And I had probably 300-400 answers right away that they loved it. But then I did a little more thinking about it, and I said, well, it may be good in one respect, but it's awful unfair to the defendant. And haven't these people heard of rewriting a bond and staying on the bond or guaranteeing to stay on the bond rather than do this? I think it's going to open up a door to pretrial release to say, we don't need the bondsman because it's only going to cost $60 if we do it, but if a bondsman does it, it's 10% of whatever the bail is. So I'm glad you got a hold of Dale and bring him in here to clarify it for us and tell us what's really going on out there.
Yeah, okay, Dale, I guess this is your moment in the in sunshine.
All right, I'm ready. I'm ready. So as with many stories, what appears in the paper is quite a bit more complicated than what we read. And the first thing to understand is that in California, the Penal Code statute 1305 is what controls bail bond forfeitures and, in some respects, bail bond exonerations. And for decades now, as part of the statute, one of the very first things is that if a defendant is arrested and the defendant bails, no matter what source of the funds, whether it's a surety bond or his own cash or a property bond, the DA must bring charges within 15 days of the defendant's arraignment, or now they call it first appearance. If the DA does not bring charges within that time frame. The rationale behind the statute is that that defendant's assets cannot be held hostage while the DA fiddles around with deciding to bring charges or not. In operation in today, it may not work quite so well, because while the DA has plenty of staff, but they also have an awful lot of demands because of charges, they're going to focus on violent crimes. They're going to bring charges against somebody within in a timely manner if there's violence involved. But other types of cases where they might feel they need more investigation to determine whether a felony is warranted, they may not bring charges in time. And in practice, what this court has done in this county is they've simply continued the case for 30 days or so, and the defendant would appear. And it was not uncommon to have two or three appearances like that, stretching out 90 to 120 days, the defendant making appearances with no charges filed. Well, I think maybe what happened is charges were brought against a defendant who then subsequently failed to appear, and a bail agent may have not been able to return that defendant to custody successfully within the time frame, and recognize that by operation of law, because of the way the statute is written, that bond had already automatically been exonerated many months before. Enough of those cases, the court would take notice, and I suspect that's what's happened here, is the court looked at it and said, wait a minute, this is already happening whether we do an order or not. We need to advise defense counsel that this is an issue that will be addressed in the future.
Oh, okay. That was great legal speak. But what does it mean in real terms? I'll use my favorite example. I toilet paper my next door neighbor's tree, and the police arrest me, and I bail out. My bond is set at $1,000. So I fessed up my $100. Does this mean that, 15 days later, if official charges haven't been brought on me, I'm gonna have to bail out again?
Well, and that's where it gets complicated. What we're going to do here locally is we're going to advise the defense counsel and the court that we can rewrite that bond, that we can issue a new bond referencing the original bond number, and by doing that, that would allow the initial premium to carry forward to the new bond. So, in short, the defendant would not be charged any more premium, and we would still stay on liability to guarantee that defendant makes all of their court appearances.
But the way
it is right now, the bond would be null and void, and you would have to write a new bond, therefore a new premium would be needed for your toilet paper act.
Yeah, that's, and so where it gets complicated with the defense bar is my understanding, of course I'm not a surety expert, but my understanding is that a rewrite works if it's done before exoneration or before forfeiture. If it's if the bond is already exonerated, then the surety will demand new premium from me because they have to pay their surety tax on that. And and if it's done after forfeiture, then that's a whole different matter because it's already been in breach. And if that's correct, then what will have to happen is the defense counsel would have to look at the file, look at the case, say 2 weeks, 14 days after the arraignment. And if there's still no case filed, they would have to then notify us and say, hey, will you rewrite this? And we go in and deliver a new bond before the end of the next day.
Now, you're in California.
Yes.
Cobra and Matt are in Florida. So we have coast-to-coast coverage on this. Cobra, how would you feel about this?
Well, I think that, you know, Florida is, no, we rewrite bonds all the time. You know, we agree to stay on the bond with an affidavit. If they're charged with another crime, we'll stay on that bond. We won't violate them off of that. We'll write a new bond. And or we could do start from scratch and rewrite the whole thing. The fear of it to me would be this, that if we did exonerate the bond within 15 days and then the state brings charges against you again, it's like Dale said, we're going to have to collect another premium from you. Now, as far as, you know, bondsman's by and large, you know, you're getting two clients at the same time, or maybe even three clients, depending on how much they drag their feet. But it's unfair to the defendant to have to continue to pay a premium, so I'm all for a rewrite. And also, one of the holdbacks in there, one of the segues, I believe, pretrial would jump right in the middle of that and say, hey, why don't we just pretrial these guys until you make up your mind, and then everything would be pretrial, and the bondsman would lose out all the way around. So I think Dale's got the right idea to get them to do a rewrite before the exoneration, and then, you know, it's a win-win for everybody. I mean, no sense in being greedy and no sense in, you know, putting all this drama on the defendant, especially if all you did was paper your next-door neighbor's house with toilet paper. You know, I'm pretty much willing to let that one go, you know. Just don't do it again, Simon.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I won't even bring up my other favorite one about abusing the neighbor's iguana.
Well, if you do that, I think they ought to put you in with a no-bond hold and just keep your ass in there. That's what I believe.
Dale, pretrial. Is it a good thing for the bond industry?
Well, it's hard to characterize it as a good thing. I think an accurate characterization is that it's a real thing. It's something that we're dealing with. I've had the fortune of, in my 25 years, of not operating in a county that had a pretrial program, but that's changing December 1 in Sonoma County. It's been something that we've been aware of for the last several years, that the county has been trying to get together and get funded. And we pretty well saw that it wasn't going to happen, that they didn't have the funds for it until realignment came along. And if you're not familiar with realignment, that's the Governor Brown's experiment, a massive experiment. We're releasing 40,000 prisoners from state prison and realigning their supervision to the counties. In some cases, they'd be in custody in the jails and in the county jails, and in some cases, they'd be monitored by probation officers out of the counties. And along with that, beyond just the stress onto the local systems, came additional monies. So our county and many counties in California have pretrial release as a means to deal with that.
Uh-huh.
Well, let me jump in real quick, Dale. If you were opening up, and this is my theory, if you were opening up a business, right? All right, you just open up a business. What would you expect to be successful? How would you expect to be successful?
Take care of my clients.
And
charge
repeat,
a fair
and,
price.
And repeat what?
Oh, repeat clients, absolutely, and referrals.
Exactly. That's the way that the jail, that's why they like PTR, because, hey, they know it's not going to be successful. They're going to be coming back. The recidivism is going to be high, and they're there to make money. If they're really there, think about it. If the prison was going to rehabilitate and everything's good and there's a lot less people coming in, we wouldn't have prisons. We wouldn't have overcrowding. you know, there people we wouldn't have any jobs. It's ran like a business, and I will repeat and stand by it. It's ran like a business.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, once you get the system, it's hard to get out. Once they get you into pretrial, they don't want to let loose of that.
Nope.
Now, that's instant money. You know, our pretrial is figuring out how to collect money from you on a weekly or biweekly basis, and we call it pretrial probation because basically you're guilty. You'll be piss tested and paying a fee to them for piss testing and monitoring and everything else. So it's actually worse than being out on bond. It's a whole jump through.
Same thing with the diversion. You go to these drug rehab programs, you got to pay for that. You go for alcohol programs, you got to pay for that. So it's all cash cow.
Well, the diversion programs, I understand those. You've admitted that you've got a drug problem and you don't want a record, so you go into a drug rehab. Well, you need to pay for that. But
exactly.
But the pretrial release, you're paying for something that you may very well be innocent of
innocent.
The charge.
Right.
Exactly. So there's a big difference between the two. But man, Dale, get ready because you've never experienced anything like this in 25 years, buddy.
Oh, I am getting ready, and it's a bit alarming. It was going to be worse in this county than what it turned out to be. Because the court stepped in and said, no, you can't deny somebody's right to post bail. You still have to allow them to post bail if they don't want to have those conditions set.
Cool.
If the court hadn't said that, then it would be significantly worse.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's super cool because in our state, they're not doing that. They're actually grabbing them up. And, you know, pretrial, we've discussed this many times. It began in, I think it was 61 as the Manhattan Project. And on a small scale, it looked pretty good. And it was designed for those that, you know, were indigent, didn't have any money. They were in jail a long period of time. It was also set up for the ones that had really no criminal background or anything else. Now they're releasing them if you've, you know, committed an armed robbery with a firearm and you've got a whole rap sheet. And you've got, you know, $100 million, they're still pretrialing them. So the pretrial, and they're not taking out the indigent ones because the indigent ones don't have any money, so they can't fund the broke. So their whole network of ideology that they've sold to the taxpayers is a bunch of bunk. And it's not working. It needs to be revamped. And I'm all for some judges passing a law that says, listen, it is the defendant's constitutional right to make bail if that's what he so chooses, rather than jump through all you guys' hoops. But they've taken it a step further and put him on pretrial and a bond at the same time. So basically they double-dipped it. And, you know, the guy, you're innocent until proven guilty unless you're a bondsman. Then you're guilty until proven innocent because in Florida you lose your license immediately upon arrest and you get them back when the case is cleared. So, but if you're put into jail on something you didn't do, and you're set to go to this pretrial release program and a bond, to me, I think it's like double dipping, and it's constitutionally unfair.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think that would hold muster in California.
Perfect.
I hope not.
Right, but that is what's happening in Florida, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, pretrial. Is being tagged with a regular bond.
Yes. Well,
there's something inherently wrong with that.
Well, it's wrong all the way around, but as far as the government, the municipality is concerned, it's a great thing. The bondsmen's were raising all kinds of hell against pretrial and doing the stats themselves and showing that they were not just taking out the indigent, they weren't taking out the ones that had minor, you know, offenses. They started compiling reports showing that they were letting out, you know, major felons, people that had money. You know, basically nobody really in jail has any money or access to get to money. We're dependent upon the debtors, and you know, pretty much everybody has someone on the outside that can bring you money, and therefore the indigent status is not there. Now, there are a few that are transient folks that travel from here to there, or, you know, they have other problems like their mental illness or something like that that makes them indigent. That's what the program was designed for. But when these bondsmen started compiling these reports and talking about them, such as we're doing here, they scurried really quick, pretrial folks did, and said, you know what? We don't want these bondsmen making all this noise. So look, bondsmen, hey, you can share with us. Here, we're going to put him out on a pretrial, and you can attach a bond to it. In fact, we're going to demand both, bond and a pretrial. But the bondsmen became happy with it, and a lot of bondsmen that were keeping these records, I've talked to several of them, and they say, Cobra, we don't have a problem with pretrial anymore. If you're a bondsman, you always got a problem with pretrial. That's somebody coming in trying to take your money at any given point. And the reason they think they don't have a problem with it now is because they're writing a bail bond right along beside that, but all they're doing is segueing pretrial to say, look at us. Our numbers are as good as the bail bonds, because the bail bondsman, he's going to go get his guy and bring him back. Pretrial's not going to do it. So they're robbing our stats, and they're collecting money. To me, all the way around, it's just an illegal operation. I mean, they're the criminals. You know, that's my opinion. They're acting on a criminal intent here.
Well, when Pretrial had the dog and pony show in this county and in other counties in California, one of the things that they claimed is that they have a really high percentage of return to courts. So they were saying that their numbers are 90%, 92%. They point out the Washington D.C. program as the Cadillac program, and say that it has a 95 or better percent of returning defendants to court. And I looked into that and I thought, well, that's just incredible. How could that possibly be true? And I talked to Dr. Dennis Bartlett with the American Bail Coalition. And he explained to me that what they're doing is they've changed how they calculate the statistics, and they went to what they refer to as an event basis. Now, when I have a defendant that I bail out, that defendant might have 10, 15, 20 appearances before the case is all over with. And if that defendant fails any of those appearances, doesn't appear in court, well, that's a total failure for me. That's 100% failure for that defendant. I have to return that defendant to custody or I pay off the bond. But what pretrial release does now is they count each time that the same defendant is to be in court as one event. And if a defendant has 10 events and makes every one of them but the sentencing appearance, then they consider that a 90% success rate because he made 9 out of 10.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
I like the arithmetic, man. That's pretty good. Take a little blood out of the car, put it in that arm, and you're good to go, brother. You're not losing no blood. We just put it right behind
that. That kind of goes back to Matt's question about how do you run a business, and one way is to make it look good no matter what.
No matter what. I guess the pencil is a very important tool, you know.
Okay. The major question that's always asked about pretrial is how does this help? And the answer is our jail system is overloaded. So by letting these people go essentially on their own recognizance, because that's what it is, and you know they agree to turn up every week and take a piss test, life is good. Well, life isn't good. I mean, pretrial release person, if they don't want to turn up in court, they don't. And guess what? No one cares. except the taxpayer. But even the taxpayer doesn't care because he or she doesn't understand that you know, taxes are being used to, you know, fund this program. Am I wrong, Cobra?
No, you're absolutely right. In fact, Broward County, it's about a $5, $6 million a year direct taxpayer for pretrial. And that's only with numbers pretrial showing. Dade County is about the same thing. Other counties have, you know, varying amounts. But $5 million, for example. All right, now you have a warrant squad that has to concentrate on going out and getting these guys. That money is also, which is not part of pretrial's budget, is coming right out of tax. And then to put them back in the system again, they didn't do anything but repopulate the jail again. It's kind of an open door, closed door, open door situation. So, you know, the taxpayer, the common taxpayer, is not aware of it. But the bondsmen that are looking at it going, I couldn't run my business like that. If I did, I'd be out of business. And it's just a direct pull on the citizens. And, you know, it may have had its place at one point in time, and it may still have its place, but they're abusing it. And, I mean, if they really took it down to the indigent ones and the ones who have a very low criminal history, misdemeanor at best, they would probably only do 4 or 5 defendants a month versus hundreds of defendants. So the first couple of go-rounds, they're making money on the defendant because he's paying his little bit of money to show up, and then at one point he decides to go, and he goes. Now, he could go to the next county, which just overburdens that county as well. We're still in the same state, but our pretrial system is not looking for them. If they get pulled over in a car, maybe. But a bondsman on the other side is hunting them. He's going to the Demeters. He's going to houses. He's tracking this guy for everything because that's his livelihood. That's his money. And he's going to go find it and bring it back. That's why they have such a high return. So I don't know that pretrial, you know, they started it, worked great on a small system. But I don't know that anybody really is qualifying for it anymore except some real, real indigent folks. And some of the folks that I've spoken to, they're still not getting out of jail. Pretrial ain't going to take them out either. So what is the system for other than making someone rich?
Well, I also read somewhere in their cover where they start talking about it saves the government money if they're releasing defendants from pretrial.
Okay.
And when I was reading, there's like for keeping them inside, it runs about $20,000 to $25,000, say per person. And they said release them would be about $5,000 per person.
Right.
And I was reading the stats where it would say if they had 40-something thousand per day released on PTR, that would save the government like millions. And when I mean millions, like 700-something million per day. That's what the stats, that's statistically, that's what they were saying.
Well, that's what Dale's saying. You know, they're in charge of the pencils. You know, they manufacture these pencils with a special lead that does all this calculating. But the thing of it is we have more bail bondsmen per capita than any other state, pretty much. I mean, we have a slew of them. And these guys are dropping bonds. They don't know the defendant. They don't know the Demeter. They don't know anything. Somebody gets in jail, if they can post a bond and get them out, they get them out, and then they worry about all the details later. So they're hungry. So for a bondsman, you know, it doesn't make any sense to me that people are in jail and they can't get out of jail because no bondsman's taking them out. I don't believe that. Bondsmen are not getting a chance to take them out because at first appearance, they're getting pretrial and off they go. And, you know, there's a lot of bondsmen that love to take them on. And, you know, probably 70-80% of them are no rich bonds anyway. And then you have a few that are, but, you know, bondsmen's pretty risky when they get hungry. So I don't see where it's a real win for anyone. I think they're just, you know, got these magic pencils that they're doing these stats with, and that's what is driving the whole system. And, you know, any government facility, once they get their hands on the checkbook or the books that's got money, they don't want to let loose of it. No matter how failing it is, they've got to be told to let go by a higher authority.
Dale, I would love to get your comments.
Well, I, you know, it brings up a recollection of the discussions during the implementation of realignment. And the ACLU here in California was very much leading the charge to they were blaming a lot of the local in custody populations on bail bondsmen as charging too much money or bails too high, which we, of course, don't have anything to do with, as the reason that the local jails are overpopulated. And they put out a report that I read, and it was from July and September of 2011, and it has the pretrial population percentage-wise of about 20 of the counties in California. And just to give you an example, Alameda County, which is where Oakland is, they had 83% of their jail population were there on pretrial. Los Angeles County, 70% of their population were pretrial. Let's see, there's another good one here. Solano County, 80%. Those are counties that Santa Clara County, 71%. Those are counties that have had pretrial programs in place for decades. And to compare that to two counties of which I have intimate experience, the first county I did business in was Tulare County, never had a pretrial program. Its pretrial population was 59%. Sonoma County, of which I do business now, hasn't had a pretrial program. Its jail population was 52%. So all counties that don't have a pretrial program have the lowest percentage of pretrial in custodies.
Todd, stop washing the dishes.
I'm multitasking, Simon.
Don't be doing that shit. Mute your phone if you do that shit, because it sounded like you blew up something.
Sorry, guys.
Sorry.
Okay. I do apologize for that. Todd's just a youngster.
My bad.
So yeah, you're right. And pretrial doesn't seem to come out all that well in the stats.
No. All depends on who's holding the pencil, Simon. That's all.
What is the way forward, though?
Education. Education. That's the only thing we can do, Simon, is to educate and continue to beat the band on it. I mean, we've gotten a long distance by raising hell so far, but the comeback was, okay, we'll attach a bond to it then. How does that make you happy? No, that doesn't make me happy, because I'm smart enough to know what you guys are fixing to do next. So let's drop back pretrial to where it was supposed to be, instead of this money cow that you guys got working for you, and let these bondsmen come on up to the plate and start bonding them out. Listen, there's bondsmen every day trying to get somebody out. They go down there trying to get them out. Oh, pretrial. You know, so it's not... You know, the jail population is no fault of the bondsmen whatsoever. You know, there's people in there that have people on the outside that can come up with the 10%. Florida is well known for taking a percentage of that 10% and putting them on a payment plan. So there's really no excuse for it. They don't have to come up with the entire 10% all at once. There's so many of them running payment plans and doing different things, trying to help them out. That's their business. That's what they do. But they're not getting a fair chance with it, because pretrial is popping them out. And if you raise hell with it, then they'll attach pretrial to the bond as well. So, you know, the defendant's getting screwed over left and right. And I think it's going to take somebody. And see, what happens is we have bail coalitions and, you know, we have bail bond associations and stuff. But it's like NIMBY, not in my backyard. So if it's not affecting, you know, a certain group of bondsmen or some of the more affluent bondsmen, then they're not stepping up to the plate to help the other bondsmen, you know, get a guy to go up to Tallahassee, to our state capitol, and raise hell with them and meet with the lawmakers and say, listen, this is not working. You guys are, you know, interfering. Florida's a right-to-work state, and you're keeping them from working because you guys are coming in and taking over all this stuff. You know, there's so many things wrong with it. You know, there's so many things wrong with the system, Simon. It's going to take, you know, a coalition of bondsmen getting together and doing the same thing that pretrial does and beat the bandwagon and have town meetings and start showing folks that this is why it's not working and this what will work and this is how we can all work and get along.
And I would love to get your thoughts, Dale.
Well, yeah, education is huge. Educating the policymakers, educating the other bail agents. One of the things that they could use education talking points. It's a vast subject, and what I've noticed here in California is that pretrial doesn't talk about getting people out of jail as much as they talk about providing information to the court. And that was a real selling point in this county. The judges were sold on an idea that they would have a defendant in front of them on arraignment, and they would also have a report in front of them that would tell them everything from the likelihood of the person reappearing to the likelihood of the person reoffending to what sentence would be appropriate for that defendant when that time came. And that was the driving force for the decision to implement it. That was what they call a risk assessment tool.
They use the same thing here.
Did you find it an effective strategy?
As for the pretrial people, yes, it was very effective. From the bail standpoint, one of the things that we provide is a service that does not incriminate the defendant or the cosigners, that anything they tell me is going to be confidential. And that cannot be true for pretrial. When they're asked questions, they release information. That information is now in the criminal justice system.
And here's another thing, Simon. Again, you know, that's the driving force behind pretrial. That's how they go to an area and convince them that they're a better program because they do all this. Okay? They say that, but here in the many counties in Florida, they don't have time to do that. That defendant came into the jail system at 3 o'clock in the morning. He's at first appearance at 8. They haven't had time to pull his entire record. Some counties, as we've discussed in the last programs, they've only pulled for that particular county. They've not done an NCIC search. They've not done a Florida IC search. They've not done any of that. It's just for that county. And the county right next door, the guy's got 7 warrants. But they didn't even include that. All right. So they don't do their homework that they've, you know, they've sold a pig in a poke. They don't do what they said they were going to do and find out the likelihood of reoffending. The charts that I sent you last week, with the defendant got pretrial. Here he is, a convicted felon with a firearm committing armed robbery, and he's out on pretrial. You got to be kidding me. So who did his homework? You know, the chances of him robbing somebody else with a pistola, being he had 10 pages of stuff anyway, I would say were pretty great. So they use that basically as a selling tool, and it sounds great. But on the bail bond side of it, we don't do that, just like Dale said. Also, you know, again, it seems to be that we keep violating these defendants' rights because you're in there for papering your neighbor's house. You're not in there for molesting his lizard. You're not in there for your speeding tickets that you had last month. I mean, you've already done time for those things, paid the cost to be boss on that, and you're telling me they're going to bring all these things in again against you? That's kind of like you're being tried now as an offender. I mean, what is this, 3 strikes and you're out kind of deal? I mean, you haven't made the first day to court, and yet they're going to bring all this. So I see it as it was a great selling tool that pretrial release has put forth. And if I was a judge, I'd probably buy into it too. But then when I find out they don't really do all that work that they say they do, and then secondly, somewhere along the lines, it seems like it's a violation. You know, you know, most attorneys would argue that prior bad acts are not brought into the, you know, they get those knocked out. Because if we had prior bad acts, shit, we wouldn't have enough prisons. We would have to start building them again.
Well, let me ask you this. What's the recidivism rate between PTR, ROR, and just someone out on bond? Does anybody know?
Well, it's interesting you bring up recidivism because that's one of the key things that's been the battleground here in California. The whole concept behind realignment was to reduce the number of people in custody and increase the amount of treatment programs so that they can learn new behaviors, so they avoid criminology behaviors. Well, the key measurement is the recidivist rate. And the problem is that each county reports the information to the state, and no county has a unified definition of what is recidivism. So the state enacted empowered a committee to come up with that definition, and they just did. It's not official yet. They're waiting. It'll be official next month. But what won't be included in the definition of recidivism is somebody violating probation or parole. So if you're released on probation or parole for an offense and you violate that parole or probation, that's not a violation. That won't get triggered as going back to old behavior, at least statistically.
That makes no sense.
Absolutely not. Wow. But what it does do is it reinforces the idea that
mm-hmm.
worked. And
well,
so
this is
when
what
they come out to the voters,
40?
They're going to say, look how we've improved this rate.
Right.
Wow.
I read where it was 40%, almost up to 40% recidivism rate for PTR. 15 to 16% ROR, or other divisions of release, and only 9% out on bond.
Wow. That's pretty good stats there, Todd. Damn good. But, you know, it's like us as bondsmen. You know, and Dale, you'll do it as well. The only thing I really want to know, and most of the bondsmen want to know, is FTAs. How many times this defendant has failed to appear? You got 4 or 5 FTAs. Chances of you getting bonded out with a smart bonding company ain't going to happen. Now, there's some out there that take a chance on you. In fact, we had one the other day that was, you know, I think they want to change insurance companies because we would not allow them to bond the person out on a $75,000 bond, and they already had 4 FTAs, 3 that we knew about, 1 that the defendant himself told us was different, and yet his mother said, don't bond him out. He's got 7 FTAs. So it's like, you know, that's the only thing that would trigger us. You know, I don't care if he robbed 4 grocery stores. All right, he's a robber. That's what he does. That's how he makes his living. I don't care if he slung, you know, 100 pieces of crack. That's what he does. He sells crack. But when they fail to appear, that makes everybody a little bit on the nervous side because we're going to have to hunt him. You know? So,
yeah, that's true.
A violation of probation or a violation of parole, I mean, damn it, you were let out of prison and given a chance to do right, do the right thing, and you violated that. Now, why is that not part of your repeat behavior process if you're going to have a repeat behavior process total card, you know, scorecard? Why is that not on there? To me, see, the problem is anytime we got the government messing with something, they damn sure going to mess it up. They get overstudied and under this and over that, and next thing you know, it's just costing a lot of money, and then we got to come in and fix it. And then they say, see, we fixed it. No, you didn't. We fixed it, but you're not giving us credit for it. On a couple of shows, I don't know how it is if you see, I'm a hunter. I'm just now, you're 57, and I'm getting ready to open up a bail bond company, or 2 or 3 or 10 of them. I've never had one. I've posted probably 30 bonds in 38 years, but I've caught 9,500 fugitives. So I know about catching fugitives and hunting them down. That's my main thing is doing that. I figured if I got 1,000, I'd open a bail bond office, but I think I'm going to do it at 9,500. But the thing of it is, you know, I know my side of it, but you know, on the other flip side of it, they're not going after these guys, and I don't get any credit from the state from the county, from the government, for any captures. I can take 10 people to jail today, and it's going to show that Officer B got them, Officer C, they were turned into main jail. The state's getting no stats, and pretrial is getting no stats. We're not getting no stats. And we take them like Jacksonville, for example. We take them inside the jail just like a law enforcement officer. We go into their computer system. We enter that defendant into that computer system. We book him, fingerprint him, do everything we need to do to him just like an officer would. Now, that's the only county in the state of Florida I know that that happens. But you got to go in there and do all the booking process, book him totally into the jail. And then when you see the stat on it, some officer got that stat. You didn't get that stat. And so we as bondsmen don't get any stats whatsoever. So that's what's crippling us a little bit along this pretrial and these, you know, these reports that are coming out, how successful they are.
Well, you know, my friend Topo Padilla, who has a bail agency in Sacramento County, you know, he recognized some of the same things you're talking about. He came up with a method of tracking success and in the amount of outstanding warrants on persons. And so
cool.
He goes every month to his Sacramento County jail or courthouse and gets the number of outstanding warrants, and then he breaks that down, how many of those people bailed out. And I don't recall exactly what the numbers are, but they're eye-popping. They're perhaps like 9,000 open warrants, 20 of them for bail people.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, because a bondsman can't stay in business very long. If he's losing defendants and he can't find them, he's not staying around very long. Once he starts paying that back, it's not going to make any sense. He'd be better off to work at Wendy's.
Well, you know, back on that recidivism talk, another stat that isn't included in the definition of recidivism is any of new offenses 3 years after the last offense. So in other words, if somebody's convicted of a crime and then 4 years later they're convicted of another crime, that's not considered a recidivist.
Oh, boy.
Oh, okay. So if I get busted for toilet papering my neighbor's tree and 4 years later, you know, I abuse my neighbor's iguana.
No.
That wouldn't be included in the stats.
No, that would indicate that there is no recidivist problem in your neighborhood.
But there is a lizard molester out there on the loose. Hey, before we run too short on time, I did want to touch on another subject that has theft all over it, and I'm kind of burnt on the issue, but, you know, and there's a lot of bondsmen out there right now that are, you know, doing some crazy shit, and it happens to be with on skips. And if you don't mind, I'd like to share with just an outline of it and see if Dale or anybody had any problems along these lines. Are you ready for that, or do you want to move for a second, or what?
No, feel free.
All right. Here's the deal a lot of people don't know. You know, I chase skips all over the country. I mean, I'm a legitimate chaser. I'm a bail bondsman. In Florida, you got to be a bail bondsman. In other words, I can write bail or I can just hunt fugitives. Well, I've decided in my 30-plus years to hunt fugitives. And most that know me know I'm very good at it. Probably, I don't know, they say I'm real good at it. But anyway, the thing of it is when a defendant goes on the run, a felony defendant, he is typically put into what is known as NCIC, meaning he is wanted state to state around the country. Any law enforcement agency picks him up, they will transport his butt back to Florida. All right, so the bondsman that wrote the bond on him will hire a guy like me or go themselves and go to a far-off state and bring him back. They're operating under the law, Taylor versus Tainer. So, and a lot of people, and a lot of bondsmen, I know you're listening to this because we were all over Facebook about this today. are very, very confused about Taylor versus Tanner. Yes, you can go into another state. Yes, you can kick in their doors. Yes, you can do this and this and this, but there's plenty of exceptions. There's several no-bond states. That's a federal law by chance, by way.
Kentucky.
And there's several states that Wisconsin, Kentucky, Illinois, there's certain states you cannot go in. And if you do, you're kidnapping and you'll leave there a felon. Now, someone was talking about coming into Florida, and somebody else said, well, if you're a bondsman, you wrote the bond, sure you can go into Florida. No, you cannot. If you come into Florida, you will need to be a Florida bondsman or be with a Florida bondsman. And I always offer my services and the people I know around the state to help you guys out that are coming in out of state to make an arrest so that you don't leave here a felon your damn self. Now, the one thing that really gets my goat is this. Some of these misdemeanor bonds are getting pretty high. There's $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $25,000 misdemeanor bonds that are not NCIC. They are not extraditable outside of Florida. So the guy sitting over in Georgia on a misdemeanor bond, and the bondsman is out $10,000, and he's decided he's going to go on up there and get this guy. Well, there's a problem, because what we have is a uniform criminal extradition treaty between the states. So some bondsmen did this week and took off. I'm not mentioning any names. They went to far, far away land, and they brought back a misdemeanor defendant who was not in NCIC. Now, my first argument is this. I say that the prosecutor, I go to the prosecutor and say, listen, I have located my defendant on this misdemeanor bond. He is in Virginia, and he's living at his mama's house in Virginia. Would you please put that misdemeanor into NCIC so that I can properly get him extradited back down here, either myself or with the aid of law enforcement? And they say, no, we're not going to do that. Then I say, you should let me off the bond because you're restricting me as to what I can do. Basically, you're going to get me in trouble by me going up there on this warrant for this guy that's only honorable in the state of Florida. So what I found out is that if the prosecutor won't put a defendant into NCIC that's on a misdemeanor bond or any bond, any criminal felon for that measure, they should immediately release us from our obligation. And to not do so, I believe it's a pure theft upon the bondsman, because they know we can't go get them, really. I mean, yeah, we can say Taylor versus Tanner, we're going to go get them, but really we could get into more civil liability by doing that, going and getting that guy, but they don't really want us to go get them. Why? Because that's how they're really getting their money. They only get $5 on a $5,000 bond. That's all the state's getting because we're bringing him back. But if we fail to bring him back, they're getting $5,000. So let's not put him in NCIC, and let's make this bondsman, we already know he's in Virginia, so why? No, leave him up there. So I just don't know if you have a problem with that out there, Dale, or not, but I think there should be some cleaning up. You know, if you want this guy back, then you should put him in NCIC, because I'm telling you that he left the state, and I know where he's at, and I want to go get him. But if you're not going to put him in NCIC, you should let me off my bond. Have you had anything like that, Dale, happen to you?
Well, I mean, my first comment is any time you're quoting or relying on a law that case law from 1873 is your primary authority to do something, you're in some pretty choppy waters.
Yes, sir.
We do have, you know, California has pretty advanced statute bail exoneration and forfeiture protocols, and one of those is that that if a defendant is in custody in the custody of the bail outside of the jurisdiction, meaning in another state, and the bail, meaning the bondsman or the bondsman's agent, takes that defendant to that local law enforcement, who then positively IDs the defendant as being in the custody and signs an affidavit to that effect, then we're eligible for a release on that bond. Now,
cool.
It doesn't always work. But it does cover situations where we'd be exposing ourselves to criminal liability, like people can run to Oregon. Oregon's a no-bail state, so Oregon doesn't recognize a bail bondsman's right to arrest in Oregon. My understanding, and you probably know better than me, Cobra, because I'm just the opposite of you. I've been doing this 25 years, but I don't do skips. I found that I'm much better at assessing risk than I am at waiting out in front of people's houses at 3 o'clock in the morning. So I stay out of that world, and I let the pros like you do that. But my understanding on NCIC is, at least how the California law enforcement uses it, is it's felony only, and the county that enters somebody into the NCIC system is already agreeing ahead of time that they'll extradite.
Mm-hmm. Now, we went to the prosecutor and said, listen, he's in Virginia. I'm just throwing Virginia out there as an example. He's in Virginia. He's at 4200 Mockingbird Trail. Listen, if you'll put him in the NCIC, we will pay all extradition costs to bring him back. It's not going to cost taxpayers a penny. We're going to agree to pay all that. But we want to be able to bring this defendant back so that we don't end up having to pay the full bond to the state, and they're refusing it. And I think when they do that, then they've tied our hands and we can't. And, you know, a lot of bondsmen say, well, I'm under Taylor versus Tanner. I'm going to go on up there and get him. We'll go on up there and get him. I've sat in the back of too many squad cars explaining after the fact of why. And, you know, when you get to be 57, you start to realize you don't want to be in the back of a squad car again. Side of things. So, I mean, I've been around the horn a few times, and one of the other veteran agents, Rod Dawson, is probably listening. He's in South Carolina right now trying to get his fugitive. But Rod has been a pickup guy as long as I have, and he is of the same schooling that, you know, if you're going to prohibit me from going and getting my guy, you know, this Taylor versus Tanner, you know, there's been misquoted and misused, and like you said, you know, any law that's beyond the 1900s, you're really in choppy water, and the Uniform Criminal Extradition Act is, you know, a good way to find yourself in jail snatching somebody from another state and sneaking back across state lines. You got major problems with this. But I would like some kind of uniformity that the bondsman was unrestricted. Otherwise, they're going to keep restricting us to where our stats are going to be just as bad as pretrials. That's it.
Okay. We're running kind of low on time, but there's one subject that I want to ask you folks about. I'm no expert. State to state extradition, and this isn't just about bail bonds. It's about law enforcement. Is it time that some laws were changed?
Absolutely. You know, if Virginia officer picks up a guy who is wanted out of Florida, and in fact, I'll give you one better. We had a child molester that had raped a bunch of small boys. He was a school teacher, and he ended up raping a bunch of small boys, and he bonded out of Lee County. And we got after him, and we drove him right to New York. Well, New York picked him up, and then he decided he wanted to fight extradition. So he was in the jail up there until our governor sent a warrant up there, and then, of course, they go through the whole extradition process, and then they send him on down the road. I look at it this way. If he has jumped bail and he's wanted as a felon in another state, and that state should just give him up. They should just come on down the road. Now, I see a lot of bondsmen have tried to get ahead of this law, and at the time of bail bonding, they have signed over an extradition permission slip, if you will. Some say it's legal, some say it's not legal. Some bondsmen carry one with them, so they run fugitive in another state. They'll say, hey, I'm going to charge you with a whole bunch of stuff unless you sign to legally take you back into your out of. So, yeah, there needs to be something changed up, because if a bondsman is a surety and becoming that person, responsible for that person, should be exempt from those particular state laws from state to state. If he is a licensed bondsman, now he's about else, I understand why they have, you know, all the drawbacks on the laws. But especially with law enforcement, there shouldn't be a moment of hindrance whatsoever if the governor of the state of Florida wants you for molesting your turtle or lizard or whatever it was. You should be brought over here to stand trial for that without a whole bunch of to do about it. So I don't know. There's so much cleaning up in the government system to do and state to state. And, you know, we can't override any laws, but we can always improve upon them and make them stronger. And that's one thing that this Taylor versus Tainer deal is. The states have made stronger laws. They didn't do away with the federal law, but made strong, like Florida. There ain't no bounty hunting going on here. You're not going to come down here and grab somebody and sneak off another state. So Taylor versus Tainer does not apply to Florida in as much as it says, you know, as much as writ. So I, and part of this program is to tell folks, listen, educate yourself. I wouldn't come to Sumona, California in the middle of the night for no kind of money until I got on the phone with somebody like Dale and said, hey, Dale, got a guy out there, want to know how I can get him back. And I want to know from that bondsman who lives there. And it's a courtesy as well. It's a respect. I wouldn't want Dale coming over grabbing a guy out of my next-door neighbor's house. You know, give us a call. Find out what the local law is and work with the bondsman in that state to help you out so that you don't get jammed.
Well, why don't they do this? Why don't they regulate all throughout the United States bail bonds and then make our license reciprocal to the fact that wherever our defendant's at, you have to be with a bail bondsman in that state and leave it at that. It's that easy.
It'd be perfect, and it would knock out all these bounty hunters, because I ran into a bounty hunter the other day. He had more damn convictions than the guy I was facing. I mean, he wasn't on any phone at the time, but, you know, it happened in Kansas. I mean, this guy has got, he's got, you know, child molestation. He's got everything, yet they allow him to be a bounty hunter because there's really no on it. There should be a uniform law state to state that makes them go through a process, and, you know, your BEA, bail enforcement, and all that stuff. You know, fine, like California's got a pretty good system. Florida's got a great system. You know, kind of work a system out and make it uniform across the United States and stop all these yahoos from kicking in doors and making it look bad on the professional bondsmen and the limited surety agents that are licensed and trained to do what we do. So that's where it begins, right there, education.
Okay, Dale, obviously you're more of a desk man rather than someone that goes out and
I prefer the title underwriter.
Underwriter.
Underwriter, buddy, that's right.
Yep.
But, I mean, what do you think, you know, if you underwrite a bond and the guy doesn't turn up, what should you do?
Well, there's, I should avoid anything that violates my laws or the laws in the jurisdiction.
You guys are a bunch of niggers, and you like to burn niggers on a steak. I bet you do.
What?
You burn niggers on a steak all the time.
We do?
Oh. I'm sorry. I just made the major mistake of bringing someone on the switchboard.
Hey, do me a favor, Simon. You got his phone number. You send that to me after the show. There's a couple Negroes sitting here in my truck is took offense to that shit.
Wow, I don't even know what to say to that.
Todd, I apologize to you, brother man. I mean, God, to be more careful.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm only half, so does that count?
Well, I'm half, so to me and you, it's a full one. But
you
I
mean full.
But I, listen, together we're full grown, but I never burn one, you.
That was just wow.
Okay, we have another one. Are you guys ready?
Keep the phone number. Keep the phone number on him, because that's one thing I like to do. I like to look him up. Shit.
Okay, here we go.
Caller guys are a bunch of nigger burners. You.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
He appeared to have a connection problem.
He's a white guy, son. Shit. We'll get the boy a dictionary and we'll help him out. We'll fix it for him. We'll give him education.
he's a persistent little critter. But
yeah,
I don't think he's going to actually make the program.
Hey, let me ask you a question. Simon, Sharon on air, what area code is it coming out of?
The infamous 111 area code.
He's internet and Skyping. Yeah, okay. If he had any real balls, he would call me direct. Listen, you can call me direct, **4#Cobra. That's my phone number, **4#Cobra. Dial it from your mobile phone. That's the only way to work. And you can call me up and tell me all the stuff. And maybe I'd like to meet with you, and maybe I educate you. You know, you never know.
Okay. I'm looking at the clock, and we've run way over time, so it's time to wrap this up. So I'm going to start with Dale. Any parting thoughts for us?
My parting thought is that government doesn't always have the only solution to whatever the problem, including the criminal justice system. The private enterprise has solutions. They work differently than government solutions. Sometimes they work the same way, but they almost always work better.
Indeed.
Indeed.
And Rod, not Rod.
Todd.
Matt Todd. It rhymes with Rod. You've been very quiet. I'm sure you can give us a couple of minutes of thoughts.
Well, I'm still tripping over the last caller, but but you know, my thoughts are is eventually it's going to take time before we all get on the same page. Nothing's ever going to be easy. Once we get regulated nationwide, where it's, you know, it's nothing. So it's like when they had the 911, where all of a sudden all agencies, you know, had to give up and they actually helped each other through that time. You know, that's what we need. It shouldn't be every person for himself. Once we get this regulated, where we can actually, if our bond originates in Florida, we can go after our defendant. That's going to save us, you know, so much time and trouble and save us money. But, again, I understand for what Cobra is. You're right. If they know we can't get that person in the state, they're not going to let us go, and then they're going to make their money. So it's going to take some time before we, you know, we come together and everything works smoothly.
And lastly, Cobra.
Hey, well, I've already said my piece on all that on the show, but I do want to invite that little fella. You know, I'm surprised no more education than he has. He was able to find us on the computer. But if that's as educated as he is, I've got a few educators that help him. Listen, you can call me, little fella, **4#Cobra. It's simple. Spell it out. Do it from a mobile phone. It won't work otherwise. And and you also dial **4#A bond, because you might need one of those. Todd, this is one of the guys you had on bond. And this isn't that little fella you had on bond whooped his ass. You didn't whip it good enough.
it does.
Okay, gentlemen, this has been a delight, and I want to thank you all. let's start with our friend in California. What is your website so people can find you?
www.romelli, spelled R-O-M-E-L-L-I, bailbonds.com.
Cool.
And Cobra?
You can reach me from any mobile phone, **4A*Bond, **Wanted, **Fugitive, **4Cobra. Any which way you want. Do it from a mobile phone, and I'll try to help you out. If you come into Florida, you can look me up on Facebook and send me an instant request, and I will try to get somebody to you to help you out so that you don't leave here a felon.
And, okay.
Todd.
Mr.
Well, you can
Todd.
Get me through contacting Cobra, or you can get me through my website, elusiveinvestigations.com, elusiveinvestigations@gmail.com.
Okay. This has been a wonderful discussion, and I hope we can continue it next week. Till then, this is Simon Barrett wishing everyone a happy, healthy, and safe week. Till next Saturday, goodbye.